I'm George Liston, CA.
By every serious measurement, the international reputation of the United States is now very much beleaguered. Among friend and foe alike, traditionally high levels of esteem for America are in decline, although there remains, significantly, very high regard for the traditions and accomplishments of the world's most powerful nation. Now, these conflicting circumstances suggest that this might be an apt time for the revival of a once vigorous arm of America's international statecraft, cultural diplomacy. Predicated on a belief that nations can avoid a clash of civilizations through contacts and exchanges that pursue a meeting of civilizations, cultural diplomacy has a very long history, and one of its chapters was written by American diplomats over the course of the 20th century. My guest is Richard Arndt, author of First Resort of Kings, American Cultural Diplomacy in the 20th Century. Dick Arndt, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George. Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's a marvelous book, The First Resort of Kings, so let's go right to it and to our topic. And for my benefit, Dick, and for the benefit of everyone watching, I'd love to begin with a definition of what cultural diplomacy is. And let me prime the motor of your thought, if I may, with a quote from Bill Clinton. And President Clinton once said, "We have to find a way to elevate our common humanity. That's where cultural diplomacy comes in." What do you think of that, and what do you think of this?
It's well said. I never knew he said that. I'll put that in my next book. It seems to me that nations have always related in their cultural elements, George. I mean, it's a question of people going overseas, students, books. Everything is transmitting national boundaries. National boundaries, after all, are artificial. And this kind of cultural interaction that works all the time, it works automatically. People get married, people go on tours, they look at movies and all the rest. But it's only cultural diplomacy when governments step in and say, look, this is all working very well, but it's not always in our national interest. Let's see if we can shape it a little bit to make it do what it needs to do for us to be better understood overseas and so forth. So it's the shaping of cultural relations mm-hmm. that I call cultural diplomacy.
That's very well said, Dick. You know, not only is that well said, you remind me that in the very first chapter of this book, you tell us how that has been done historically through the ages. It's a millennial phenomenon, which I had not known. Cultural diplomacy, if I got it right, Dick, far from being at the periphery, was pretty much at the center of diplomacy down through the ages. Is that fair?
That's why I call it the first resort
first
of kings,
resort of
not
kings.
The last resort, mm-hmm. which, of course, is war, as mm-hmm. we know. No, the earliest example, George, I found was in 1357 B.C., when the Egyptians decided that they would give two golden statues to a minor satrap in northern Syria. And instead of delivering solid gold, they delivered wood with gold coating on it. Mm-hmm. And the people, the Mitanni they were called, they just couldn't put it down for 7 years. They berate the Egyptians saying, you can't do this to us. The Hittites are threatening in the north and we'd have to have solid gold because people know the difference. So it's an astonishing example, and they go on. It goes on through Alexander the Great and the Romans and you name it.
That's right. You bring Alexander the Great early into the story, as he didn't early come onto history, up to Frederick II and many other exemplars.
Great second who got himself crowned king of Jerusalem when he was mm-hmm. King of the Holy Roman Empire by diplomatic means.
One of the things that you educated me on, Dick, and I think anyone reading the book as well, was how much cultural diplomacy as a phenomenon had to do with the spread of ideas worldwide.
Absolutely.
I mean, speak to that a moment, because I mean, the spread of Christianity or philosophies almost established a natural foundation for cultural diplomacy.
Sure, or from another point of view, Buddhism or whatever culture was expanding. The expansion of cultures invariably runs into barriers where they don't go any further, and the game is there to make those barriers either permeable or make them at least not warlike, mm-hmm. to make them peaceful. And that's the game of cultural diplomacy. Culture has been used by empires to extend and to solidify the empire, such as the British and the Romans and the mm-hmm. Greeks and all the others. But we've never had an empire, at least in the ordinary sense of the word, And so our fundamental thing was to shed enlightenment because we believed that a more enlightened world, sharing certain sets of values that we had, would be a better customer. And I use the word customer in the commercial sense because mm-hmm. there's nothing wrong with commerce. It's what human beings are designed to do. We call it divine and human commerce.
The free exchange of ideas. The
exchange of ideas is part of that.
And to the advantage of a free republic.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And the great empires of the past, they, for example, the Romans or the Greeks, they went out and found extraordinary individuals and brought them in and mm-hmm. trained them in order to become part of that. That polity, and then to do their service to it and to reach back out.
Well, the examples of the Romans and Greeks are very, very striking in this book. And so in a later period, in a period that sort of links that age to the age that we're concerned with, the French.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness, indeed. Because, for example, let me just rattle off the names, Montaigne, Voltaire, Diderot. They were actively, as I understood it, Dick, engaging their intellectuals in the promulgation of their culture as a way of conducting diplomacy.
The French court used its intellectuals. Voltaire lived for quite a time in the court of Frederick the Third of Germany and was clearly in touch with the foreign ministry in Paris, telling them what he learned. And Diderot went to Russia and entertained Catherine the Great for a few months. Mm-hmm. Designed her university for her. This was a standard fare. Montaigne is an extraordinary story. He had to do it all on horseback, after all. There wasn't anything else that he could do. So, and you take a painter like Rubens. Rubens was an active diplomat because the court would say, well, we need a painting for King so-and-so. And how about a painting of something that would be symbolic of the relations that we have between him? And he would come up with an idea and they would give it. And so the Renaissance was full of this kind of stuff.
Fascinating, absolutely fascinating, and one would say, may I say, it sounds so very French and so,
right,
leads to this question, Dick Arndt, when this rough new republic of ours first gets into this game, and I'm talking now, there's the book treats us as well, prior to the 20th century, this is a big period, so I'll ask you to characterize it in a brief way, but what was our cultural message? Now, a moment ago, you gave us an insight into it. The free exchange of ideas is an American advantage, culturally and diplomatically and therefore politically. But when we think of people like, well, Tom Paine, Ben Franklin, the earliest spokespersons for this country, what was their appeal, if any, in the cultural sense?
Well, you see, you're interesting. You said Tom Paine first, who was the usually third in my trinity. The first two were Franklin and Jefferson, who went out in order to convince the French that they had better support us against the British. And so they had a very, very particular job to do. Now, of course, they had no weapons, no tools, no instruments, no money, no budget, no staff, nothing to do it. They had to rely on their wits. Franklin and Jefferson were as unlike as night and day, but each one did it in his own way. Franklin by beguiling the court with his jokes and his games and his fun and by outplaying the British, and Jefferson by promoting an empire, or not an empire, but a relationship with the French Empire, which had to do with commerce and trade, which was a way around the British domination of the trade circuits on the Atlantic.
Something just dawned on me from the book and from this moment of your conversation that these men in their various ways portrayed this country.
Absolutely.
And that may be at least part of the essence of cultural diplomacy.
Absolutely.
To portray your country.
To portray and also to portray in the context in which you are portraying. For example, to take a simple example, the history of anti-Americanism in France is an engaging story. And someday you might want to invite Philippe Roger down here to talk about his new book, The American Enemy, which is a history of French anti-Americanism. But it began in 1750 with a man named Buffon, who was the greatest natural scientist in France and in Europe, for that matter. And for some reason, he had the idea that the North American continent was decadent, that the people were smaller, that the bears were smaller, that the food was decaying, the water was bad, everything was bad. Of course, it wasn't French, of course.
That's part of the main problem.
But that line of thinking persists all along through French thought, you see. So they were portraying, and Jefferson took an active role in trying to say, Buffon, you got it all wrong. There's a wonderful story about Franklin who invited Buffon to a dinner one night. And he said he listened to this man holding forth all day about these tiny little Americans. And he said, excuse me, sir, would you mind if I asked all the Frenchmen to stand up? And they all stood up. They were 5'3", 5'4". He said, now may I ask the Americans to stand up? And they were were all 5 foot 10, 6 feet. So he made his point as best he could in a gentle and civilized way.
But very graphically.
But I cut you off about Tom Paine. Tom Paine never worked for the U.S. government except for a year when he replaced John Adams in London. Mm-hmm. But essentially, Tom Paine was the most vibrant of all of these fellows, and he was also the most dangerous because right. he was preaching the doctrine of revolution
Absolutely.
All over the
place.
Absolutely.
I mean, talk about the power of ideas. Oof. It's synonymous with Tom Paine.
And it was one thing for a new nation which was trying to become known, but mm-hmm. once we had become a status quo power and had interests mm-hmm. to defend, then he was no longer diplomatically
That's right.
useful.
He's not too welcome. Moving our story into the 20th century, which is the main focus of your book, I'm very keenly interested, Dick Arndt, in actually where the story seems to start. Let me put it very bluntly. I think you level an indictment, if I may, against President Wilson and his aide, Mr. Creel, in their formation of something called the Committee for Public Information, just after World War I. I got the sense that you feel very strongly, after your own 24-year diplomatic career, that it was really a distortion of what the country should be about in its cultural diplomacy.
Creel did the right thing in this sense. He led a campaign to portray the United States abroad. He did it through any means that came to hand. That could be press or media or anything. Back at home, however, they had another problem. They had to convince the United States that it was worth going to war and
right,
sending their sons
right.
off to die. So that these two things both were attacked by any means they had at hand, so that's a kind of a means question. But the end on both sides, it had to be done. It had to be done because it was a very unpopular war. And so Wilson led us into it and Creel helped him. Now the problem is that right then began a kind of jumbling.
So right.
A jumbling together of things that don't belong together.
Let me jump in on that jumbling, if you may, just to, and you can tell me if I got this right or wrong, Dick. Are you going to say that propaganda, culture, and information as directions get jumbled, or what?
Yeah, the word propaganda is the key word there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we all know what culture is. That's what Harvard does and the Metropolitan Museum and that kind of thing. And I think we all know what information does. That's the New York Times and the mm-hmm. Washington Post. It's all very simple. But somehow, when you put them together and use anything tool you can for the power interests of the United States, that's what we generally call
right.
propaganda. And the word in the United States has a very simple history. It's been a no-no word as long as anybody can remember. Mm-hmm. Wilson himself said to Creel, do not call this the Committee on Propaganda.
Right.
So Creel came up with the word information, and we've had it all these years.
But do those tensions remain throughout your story, Dick Arndt?
Mm-hmm.
Propaganda, information, culture, how do you adjust those things?
Well, the three words have always coexisted. Mm-hmm. I frankly believe that the word propaganda has been poisoned in the United States by Hitler and by
right.
Stalin and by Mussolini and by the Japanese and so forth in the Second World War. But we still use it. I'll find people you and I know mm-hmm. Who will defend propaganda. It's what the church did
right.
In the Propaganda Fide in the 17th century and so forth and so on. I tend not to use it, and in fact I tend to say the best propaganda you can get is no propaganda at
right,
all.
Right,
that's
right.
what I tend to say. But I do think that you get a cleaner product if you run a cultural program which links intellectuals, scholars, artists, poets, whatever, on the one side, and an information program which links information sources on the other. Obviously, there are crisscrosses between the two,
mm-hmm.
obviously. But you need specialized people to deal with the intellectuals and specialized people to deal with the press.
I think that is beautifully said, and it's a wonderful introduction to the next person and the next phase I want to bring in, which your book does as well. Because as opposed to the problems of the CPI era that we've just discussed, 1932 to 1940, you depict in this book very powerfully as the period of, I thought, very fertile creation of a cultural interest in our State Department that was intended to do pretty much what you said.
Pretty much that, yeah.
And largely the creation of a very interesting figure named Sumner Wells.
Sumner Wells was the originator of the Good Neighbor Act,
right,
and, or policy anyway, and he was the Undersecretary of State, which in those days meant number two. He was the Deputy Secretary of State in today's terms, and so he was a very powerful man. And indeed, his Secretary of State was Hull.
Cordell Hull.
Cordell Hull, right. And Hull was a Tennessee tax expert. Mm-hmm. He knew nothing about foreign affairs at all, except that his taxes were import taxes. So that when Wells came in, who was a very sophisticated New York, Harvard, Groton, whatever you like, kind of a European-American, they were two very different kinds of men. So Wells had a lot to say,
right,
a lot to say about it. And he realized when he talked to the Latin Americans that that's what they wanted. They'd been pleading for cultural diplomacy for years.
That's a powerful point in this book, and I think it's good to emphasize the birth effect that Latin America, relations with Latin America, which were FDR's, one of his great goals, had to do with bringing culture into the picture. And as your book, as the book points out, Dick, culture as a form of interaction among peoples is widely respected abroad. I mean, that was one of the things that that we learned.
More than respected, almost worshipped. I mean, if you are a cultural attaché in an American embassy, you have entree that no one else in the embassy has, including the ambassador.
Well said also. During the years of Sumner's Sumner Wells' influence, I think in 1938 is a pivotal point. We got the creation, do we not, of the cultural unit, the State Department, and so forth. World War II is right on the heels of this. And here, Dick Arndt, I suspected, and this is another, I thought, ongoing tension. We have another, if you take, if you will, on this whole thing. And I gather this is represented by Nelson Rockefeller and a kind of corporatist view of what this should mean.
Well, Rockefeller went back to the Creole days. Rockefeller had connections in his family with some Creole veterans and so forth, and he thought in Creole terms, any means to an end. And he was another jumbler, in other words. And so this all got mixed up again. And the goal was to win the war at all costs. Now, that's a very fine goal at the point. Wells and the others, people like Archibald MacLeish and the young Fulbright and people like that, were looking beyond the war. They're saying we must do nothing during the war with our friends and neutrals to jeopardize what's going to happen after the war, because after the war, that's the crucial time. We've got to win that as well. Rockefeller was less concerned about that.
That purity, which you attribute to Archibald MacLeish and others, is striking, and of course it's brought forth in this book. And the personality of Archibald MacLeish is also striking, Dick Arndt. I think your chapter that you have to him calls it the MacLeish moment, because it's 1945 at the end of the war. He gets to head all of this.
He gets to head it.
And what a stroke this is, because Archibald MacLeish, and may the name never die, is a man who is a three-time Pulitzer Prize winner, poet laureate, I believe, a librarian of Congress, and now he's heading this interest. And he's saying things like, and another quote here of his is directly from Archibald MacLeish, the cultural relations of the government are its most important foreign relation.
He said it, and he believed it, and he tried to put it in place, but he only had 5 or 6 months before Roosevelt died, and Truman didn't understand Archie MacLeish from a hole in the wall. And so it... It was a great moment that passed. He was always around, and a lot of the people who agreed with him were around. But the power of the information world, you have to remember that OWI, the Office of War Information, during the war had 13,000 employees on its staff, whereas the little old Bureau of Education and Cultural Affairs had 300.
Has it always had that stepchild problem?
Oh, yeah, sure. Oh, my goodness, yes. Well, it didn't when it was all there was, when it was the only act in town from 38 to 41 or 42. And for a while there, they managed, because Wells was in charge and he was undersecretary and he chaired undersecretary's committees. And so he made sure that the thing flowed in the right channels. But the war effort, really, OWI and OSS as well, which also was full of intellectuals, by the way. There was a tremendous brain trust the OSS. People like Arthur Schlesinger and all kinds of people.
What happens after the war, Dick Arndt? And I'm going to jump our story ahead.
Sure.
And I regret doing that because every year is interesting. Every month is interesting. But if we jumped ahead to a moment that, and I'm dying to talk about this actually, 1953, the creation of USIA.
Oh, yeah.
Is this a high point, a low point, or a jumble, to use your word?
I'd say it's the institutionalization of a jumble.
Okay.
But I don't know if it's a high or a low point. It's just a point. I mean, that's the way history is. You don't get to judge these things necessarily. I think the problem was a very simple problem that you and I faced when we were both in USIA, and that is that when USIA was formed, instead of taking all of the stuff that was going on in the Fulbright, in the cultural and informational field, they neglected cultural affairs because Fulbright said, "I don't want the state, the propagandists running my Fulbright program,"
right, which was powerful in itself.
Which was a powerful component. So that stayed behind in state, and USIA went over there. And you remember that we used to divide it. USIA did the objects, and the old Bureau of Education and Cultural Affairs did the people. Now, how can you separate people and objects? Well, that was a convenient rhetoric for the moment, but, you know, it was just a problem. So we ended up with libraries, and they ended up with scholarships.
Give us at least a comment, Dickard, and this comment is far too, it's almost insulting to put it this way, because we can speak volumes on this man. But what did the tenure of Edward R. Murrow at the head of USIA in those early years mean?
First of all, Murrow was an icon for my generation. When we heard that Murrow was coming into government, that's when we all decided we're going to give government a try. This was the Kennedy era. This was the Murrow era. There was great excitement about serving your country. Do not ask what your country can do for you. You remember all that. And when I heard that Murrow was there, I said, well, that's for me. I had no idea what USIA represented. And by the merest luck, they sent me to Beirut. And so at Beirut, I was nestled in the embrace of the American University, because the embassy was right there in a little corner, as it were, of the American University of Beirut. So Murrow was a great shot in the arm, point one. Point two, Murrow was reputed to be a great friend of the Kennedys, although he didn't really like the Kennedys very much. But he came to serve the Kennedys, and he did his best. And they put him on the National Security Council. In that regard, he was at the front line of public policy, in the sense that he had an input before the stories happened. You see the difference between public relations and public affairs.
Exactly.
Public relations makes a bad story look good. public affairs makes it good from the start. And that was what he tried to persuade. And he had a lot to do with the Berlin Wall crisis and various other things that he contributed to quite markedly. But he, and all that was to the good. But the problem of the whole propaganda approach, or the public diplomacy approach, as it's called now, is that you must be in on the policy making as well as in the policy explanations. And only Murrow was ever able to do that, and in fact, not very often.
But that seems to me like, in light of all we've said and in my reading of the book, that's a high point.
It was a kind of a high point, and certainly there was a funding high point, great funding high point.
Yeah.
Maybe he didn't get quite as spectacular many funds as Charles Wick did later on, but in fact it was a high point in terms of bringing in talented people, assigning talented people to the field, and getting the money.
Well, now let me make quick mention of that, because this book does chart, and I'll leave it to the reader too, and it's very worthwhile, I must say, acquainting yourself with these people. Marvelous people that we were privileged to know, many of them. In the interest of time, Dick, let me go right to the point of your very sobering last chapters, which is basically a story, to put it again very bluntly, I think, of a 20-year decline. And some of this path to decline is paved with very good intentions.
Sure. Sure.
But if you would say a word about that, and then that will, of course, lead to a question I think you can anticipate.
Sure. I think the decline goes further back than the last 20 years, in fact, and I think you've touched on some of the points. The formation of USIA in 53 was badly done, and there were other things lacking. But the decline has been fairly steady. Take something like libraries. Libraries invented by Alexander the Great, after all, and carried on all throughout the world. When you and I were in the agency serving overseas, we had libraries wherever we were. There were hundreds and hundreds of libraries. Every city of any size had a small or a middle-sized or even a large library. And they ran like libraries. They didn't run like propaganda centers. And as years went on, the budget questions, and they said, well, how does this contribute to U.S. foreign policy? Well, Well, that wasn't really the right question, was it? The question was, how does this portray the United States? Ah, that's an easy question to answer. But how it contributes to foreign policy was a more remote question, because I think cultural diplomacy contributes to foreign policy in the years ahead, in the next decade.
The next generation.
Our payoffs are 10 to 20 years down the line. Yeah. You send a student to the United States, he goes back, he turns into somebody really great, but that's a long time later, and you can't say X equaled Y in that case. So that the decline was persistent, and as the budget situations got worse and worse. This happened partly in the 80s. There was a great burst with under Wick. But that began to dwindle. Clinton was more interested in balancing the budget, I think, than in winning this particular conflict. And the budgeteers just took over. And bit by bit, they ended performing arts, fighting visual arts, all kinds of things.
Away.
And so bit by bit, it just dwindled down. And that meant a serious loss in the field personnel.
Well, I have to say, that's powerfully said, well said, and... let me go on record saying that's very true, quite true.
In numbers, we have so many fewer people now in the field.
This is another fact, which leads to the obvious concluding question, Richard Arndt. Because as I said in the outset, we're also faced now with a national situation where we are facing unpopularity, extreme in many places. And as some columnists point out, this whole business of who's promoting culture is now often in the hands of people who don't have any particular interest in the foreign policies of this country. So if you would just take a minute to say, I guess in the old classic phrase, what must be done?
Well, there's two frameworks. We have a major problem now. We have drained the reservoirs of goodwill that we filled for 200 years. And we're running on dry right now, or empty even, in some countries. To rebuild that takes different tactics. You can't start planting for 20 years down the line in countries like that. We've got to move faster in certain countries. However, I think that must be done. However, it seems to me that in the long run, we've got to look ahead and see what kind of relations we want to have with the rest of the world over time.
Right.
Now, it seems to me that cultural diplomacy depends on people. Money comes second. People come first. If you get the right people in the right posts in the foreign context, telling the story of the United States, it's going to work out over time. Give money, that's even better.
But the right people are paramount.
You've got to get 6 good people, and then 12 next year, and 18 the following year, and onwards.
I've always looked to you for wisdom, and I think I found it again today. Thank you so much, Richard Arndt, for being with us today. You're a great friend, and as this book proves, a great author. Thank you.
Thank you, George.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Richard Arndt. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber. And our associate producer is Sharana Ward. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.